The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
Barron's Magazine runs an article on gold in 2012 saying everybody should own it. It's the most reliable investment that you can own, and it's difficult to argue with the track record, except that when you get too many people into that asset class, you ultimately run out of buyers, and the price has to go the other direction. Are you comfortably contrarian? Well, I'll tell you from personal experience, it's hardly ever the comfortable thing to be.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You know, each week we tend to talk about things that we've done that week. And Dave, you never cease to amaze me. You push your family far beyond what I think I've pushed my family. I did my first 14er when I was in my 20s, 14,000 foot peak. You know, there are over 50 14,000 foot peaks in Colorado. But you took your entire family, including, what's your youngest? How old is he?
He's 4 years old. And you know, we went over near Salida.
It wasn't a mild 14er either.
No, it was 5,000 vertical feet of climbing. Yeah. And we actually thought we could do two in a day, Chavanoe and Tabaguach. They're right next to each other. And you cross a saddle, drop a little elevation.
If one weren't enough, let's try to get a second one.
I tell you what, it was worth recognizing our limits. And it was also worth playing according to our game plan. We were up and climbing at 5 o'clock.
Yeah.
And the reason you do that is because in the summer months, you have the monsoons, which come in between 12 and 2, and you want to be off the mountain by 12 o'clock.
You know, one of our favorite books, Dave, is Deep Survival by Gonzalez. And he talks about people who have a good experience. Maybe they'll do something that's high risk and they succeed unless they know history and unless they have a plan. A lot of times that high, you know, literally in this case with a 14er, that high of success can be taken into a disaster if you don't know history. Now, you knew history. Anyone who climbs 14ers in Colorado understands you have a turnaround time, whether you've made the top or not.
Right. And it was interesting because we are sitting there at the top and it's so tempting.
Yeah.
You've already done most of the work.
Yeah.
You're 5,000 feet. You have only about another 600 to 800 foot gain to get to the other one. Why wouldn't you just do the second? Mm. Now it's an hour out and it's an hour back.
You were past your turnaround
time. And we would have been past our turnaround time. And as it turned out, as we got to the base of the mountain, sure enough, the clouds were in, the thunderclaps began, the rain started, and it was a good call to just be modestly happy with one and know that we could come back for another.
Well, especially with your whole family. You know, in a way, it's a lot like investing. If you don't know history, you can be running on an endorphin high. You know, you see the markets that are high, you want to buy higher and higher and higher. Why would it stop unless you understand history, unless you have a turnaround time?
I tell you what, it's a downer, actually. It was a downer for me to be on top of the mountain and know that we had to turn around. Mm. And yes, we made the first peak, but we weren't going to make the second. And it was sort of the end of momentum, if that's what you're getting at.
Yeah.
Because the momentum trade, the momentum trend in investing is we've made it this far, we can go a little further versus recognizing limits. There's a money manager by the name of Howard Marks, and he says the big money in the investment world, the dependable money, the safe money, is made not betting that things that have gone up a lot will continue to do so, but on betting that the things that have gone down and become unloved will rebound. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because, I mean, as we're coming down the mountain, there's people who are just marching up and they don't know better.
Right.
They really don't know better. They don't know about a turnaround time. We passed a group actually early in the morning from Connecticut. And, you know, one of them's actually lying at 13.5 in a fetal position with altitude sickness, but he is determined he's going to make it to the top. He won't quit. I appreciate his tenacity, but they don't know some of the rules of the game, which is if you don't get off, you can end up with other issues like lightning strikes and things like that.
Well, and it reminds me of the book that John Krakauer wrote years ago about the two expeditions up Everest, that they betrayed their turnaround time and it ended up costing many lives. Well, Dave, enough with analogies. Let's just move on to currency war, because we live in a day and age where it's beneficial to have a currency that's cheaper or lower value than a currency of your neighbor. Okay. And what that does is that makes you more competitive. The problem is, it's just like descending that mountain. You can only descend that 5,000 feet. Okay. There's a point where you hit rock bottom. Currencies really, in a way, have no bottom except for zero or zero buying power. Now, Venezuela has reached that zero buying power. They won the currency war for a short time, and then, of course, they lost all.
And I think the IMF now estimates that by year end, they'll be at 1,000,000% in terms of their rate of inflation.
It's a million.
If you thought,
when do you stop counting?
Exactly. At 43,000%, you begin to think you've got an inflation issue. But, oh, there's still more to the year and more to the decline in their currency.
Let's look at something bigger, though. The Chinese are purposely lowering the value of their currency.
Well, and if the Chinese orchestrate a lower RMB, we tend to accuse them of currency manipulation.
Right.
But it was just last year, our currency was declining. And if our currency declines, we don't seem to care. In fact, today we have a president that prefers a lower dollar value, and it's to do something that all leaders want, improve trade competitiveness.
Sure.
So everybody wants that. And that makes for the currency war, which is already live. And I think it's hotter than many people suspect at this stage already. So you have talk of trade policies and their importance, but I think we should not neglect currency differentials and exchange rates. And we hinted at this last week. We spoke of this last week in terms of debt and the vulnerabilities in the emerging markets, where you can have financial panic and hot money outflows from a country where they've denominated too much debt in a foreign currency. And that can be highly destabilizing, those hot money outflows. But you've got product and overall trade competitiveness, which do increase significantly with a currency depreciation. So there's actually some motive there.
And one of the ways that we try to stay away from hot war with a lot of countries is we use, I won't call it cold war, but I'll call it currency war. We have manipulated in many countries, and you know, you've done a lot of reading on this and talking on this, Dave, but Iran is a case where we used currency war to keep a hot war from happening. But don't you think politics at some point reaches a point where currency can no longer be used? Okay, the harmony of politics between China and America is what I'm thinking about right now.
Well, and even the internal politics and internal social dynamics, there's a lot of political and social harmony at stake, both inside the United States and inside China, that relates to these sort of transitional phases for trade, productivity, imports, exports, and global cooperation. So, you know, as much as Russia is still gets a number of headlines, the U.S. asks Putin for another summit, and whatever the headlines may be from the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or what have you, I think China's probably the bigger deal.
Let me ask you, though, okay, if the weapons of war are currencies and you and I have to earn a certain amount of currency, okay, we work 8 to 10 hours a day for a certain amount of currency, it seems to me like I'm at the mercy of political elephants battling and I'm just a mouse holding the dollar.
Well, I think this is kind of one of the strong reasons to consider the trajectory of gold in the coming years. You've got politicians all over the world that want their economies to boom. They want to be first in line, and they want their goods and services to be chosen before anyone else in the world that offers a comparable product. And since inflation is one of those topics that's rarely connected back to political choice or political pressure coming from politicians to the coordinators of monetary policy, investors, I think, must be aware of the vulnerability that exists to currencies, to these political priorities, where politicians are attempting to drive growth and gain market share in the global economy.
Well, is there a safe currency then? I mean, when you have fiat currency, is there anyone that wouldn't be at risk?
I think in this environment, all currencies are at risk. So for the saver and investor in the 21st century, some part of your wealth must be insulated. It has to be insulated from the desire of politicians to drive the economy forward, which, again, on the surface sounds great, but it's at the expense of the long-term stability of their currency. And I want to comment on the gold market in a moment, but you know, we have weak second quarter numbers for gold demand, and that was a reality. We'll try to look ahead to the drivers of growth that we do anticipate between now and year end as well.
You know, I stayed in a hotel that was Teddy Roosevelt's favorite this weekend, Hotel Colorado in Glenwood Springs, and you know, they have Teddy paraphernalia all over the walls, and Taft also stayed there. But I started thinking about it. I've never seen a president who actually liked strong monetary policy. Once they become elected as president, well, at least after World War II, I mean, things seem to change when the voters are really speaking the monetary policy.
The preference is there. I remember taking notes as we spoke with Giulio Gavarotti several years ago when he was on the commentary as a guest, and he made this simple observation, but it sort of unlocked a number of mysteries for me at once. It was this shift in voting which began to occur after World War II. You remember, he was talking about this shift towards universal suffrage and its implications for the budget. It became a political objective.
Yeah, the economy did.
Yeah, you politicize the budget, you connect the dots between the economy and the voter, and from that point forward, voters are far more sensitive to economic benefits that they can garner via their vote.
It's buying a vote, basically.
Yeah. And, you know, if you recall Al Sindlinger, a famous pollster, he pointed this out decades ago. It's the economy, which is the first priority for a voting base, and the second is personal security. And again, these are the things that register as priorities for voters.
And Trump's not exempt from that. Trump, at this point, is pressuring the Fed to keep rates low.
That is certainly the case. And I think part of the reason that he's keeping the pressure on the Fed and increasing the pressure, from the Wall Street Journal last Friday, Trump breaks tradition and raps Fed, you know, where in an interview with CNBC, he says, I am not happy about it, talking about interest rate increases. And, you know, the issue there is that if there is a tightening of the interest rate, a raising of rates and a tightening of monetary policy, there's likely to be a slowing in the economy. And that does matter for the politician because people vote according to their pocketbook.
Is that not really truly fake news right from the Wall Street Journal and CNBC, Bloomberg, all these guys saying that Trump is doing something that no other president has done?
Well, that was interesting because CNBC and Bloomberg covered the issue. And you're right, they talked about it as if it was without precedent. You know, yeah. Never happened. Saying essentially that the Oval Office never gets involved in steering or trying to influence monetary policy. And I think you could say that's partially true. If you think of the Greenspan and Bernanke eras, which, you know, are part of this 20-plus year credit indulgence.
Well, did they have to get involved? Because Greenspan and Bernanke were just loose guys anyway, period.
Well, that's right. So you had this period of time which was without historic precedent,
right,
which marked the final transition away from capitalism to what we now know as creditism. And you've got Clinton, you've got Bush, and you've got Obama, all who had the monetary winds at their backs, full support from Bernanke and Greenspan. But it really is not the case. It's not the case that presidents don't mess with the Fed.
Right.
You know, I mean, yes, we now have central bank activism, which has become the norm. But there was a time when central banks would, you know, sort of, as they say, lean against the wind or would move opposite the direction of the market trend to keep things in balance. Harry Truman was constantly fighting the Fed. Constantly. Lyndon Johnson invited William McChesney Martin to his ranch in Texas, and as the story goes, slammed him up against a wall, threatening him physically.
Wow.
Threatening him if he didn't, you know, adopt a more accommodative monetary policy. Nixon, you know, he put a tremendous amount of pressure on Arthur Burns. And Arthur Burns was clearly not the greatest central banker that we ever had.
Didn't Carter fire him?
He did, because Carter was pressuring him as well, and he did not ease. So here, actually, Burns has a little bit of backbone, and Carter fires Burns for not easing monetary policy prior to the 1978 midterm elections.
We had a guest, Dave, you might remember this, on our commentary, who had worked for Reagan in the early years when Volcker was raising rates. And he said Reagan and their administration hated Volcker. It was it was horrible timing in their thought process, right, to raise rates. And, you know, that's not news that we hear from the history books, but actually they hated him because they were going to destroy his possibility for a second term.
That's right. Well, easy money makes for a speculative environment.
Yeah.
And the speculative environment in stocks increases the value typically in the stock market. And that becomes easy advertisement for economic progress and growth.
So was Clinton right?
That's the prize for the politician, is to be able to say, look what I delivered on a silver platter. Look at all this, you know, well-being and wealth and everything. I mean, so that's what they're after.
So in a way, Clinton was correct in the early 90s. It's always the economy, stupid. It wasn't just for Bush. It's always the economy, stupid.
Well, and I think you'd have to go back to the 19-teens, maybe up through the 30s or 40s, where there was some confusion because people weren't really connected to economic and monetary policy in the same way that they are today. This goes back to Guido Galrodi's comment that the budget was only politicized after World War II.
It's like the weather.
It was a result of universal suffrage.
We don't think of politics controlling the weather, but if we found out that they could, that would become part of the vote, wouldn't it?
That's right. That's right. So at the end of the day, it's the economy, or it's the people's perception of the economy that drives political outcomes. You know, again, this is post-war in particular. But you've got market interventions and manipulations, which are today part and parcel to democracy. It's the way it functions, because you have politicians who are more than willing to put pressure on various organizations or create certain allowances to create opportunities for manipulation in the markets. And I don't think that would have been the case if you go back 200, 300, 400 years ago. I think democracy was a little bit different. Of course, there was, it wasn't exactly the democracy that we know today. It was, you know, five people voting out of 5 million. I mean, it was a very select number of people in the old versions of democracy.
So we have an expectation of direct participation, even though there's a public admission of separation.
That's right. That's right. And because we can connect the dots to the rewards we're getting from the markets, you know, there's more of an inclination for politicians to get involved in the process. You know, but you saw in the 80s and 90s that there was a growing disparity between the working man, who largely spent what he made, you know, living paycheck to paycheck, and didn't really see an increase in wages. We've had wage stagnation, income stagnation since the 70s up until the present. And so even though you've had the rising price in consumer goods, there's been that growing pressure for the working man. If you've had someone who was able to save any money and invest any money, then to some degree that pressure was alleviated by the inflation of asset prices. So real estate and stocks and bonds, the upper class and the upper middle class, they've benefited from the boom in asset prices, and they haven't had to pay as much attention to the rising cost of things. On balance, they are more wealthy and have had a better lifestyle than before. But this is the heart of the Trump phenomenon, which is really a populist phenomenon. We, we've talked about this ad nauseum, and it's not just in the U.S. We see the same thing which just happened in the Mexican election. This is a populist expression, only that's a populist expression from the left versus a populist expression from the right. And you go around the world, and there is a common thematic politically, but I think the source is not what people are assuming it is. It's being said that it's racism. It's being said that it's xenophobia. It's being said that it's immigration.
It's monetary policy. It's the Federal Reserve. It's loose money.
I totally agree. The Federal Reserve monetary policy, I think, is what we've exported to the world, creditism exported to the world. And now we have central bankers all over the world doing the same things, creating the same income and wealth gaps, leaving the quote-unquote hoi polloi behind. And those hoi polloi are now standing up and saying, what about us? The system is rigged. The system's not working for us. And again, it has expressions of left and expressions of right, but it's still the common man, whether it's left or right expressions, saying something's not working for us while it is working very well for you.
So would you say the deep state or the establishment, the elite, really created their own problem? They created the populist move. They created Trump.
In many senses, they did.
Whether they like it or not.
Right. Does art imitate culture or vice versa? And I think in this case, we have some sort of orange-colored art which does imitate or reflect culture in the form of the Oval Office. But you look at what's happening to the Democratic Party here in the United States, and it's losing its edge. Consider the reality of sort of the typical blue-collar, dyed-in-the-wool Democratic factory worker. And you know, they have, not in total, but there's been a creep from left to right on the political spectrum, shifting towards the GOP, at least in the last election. And I don't know that they were voting for a Republican Party line as much as they were someone who represented a non-politician, who represented, at least in the words spoken, again, that appeal to populism.
And the words weren't that eloquent. That's the thing. You know, you can appeal actually to a person when you speak in their own language. And Trump does speak in that language.
That's right. I don't think the working man is wooed with fancy words. What they want to know is that they're going to have a working wage, a better life. And to the degree that Trump can maintain the narrative of economic success, of sort of onshoring of jobs, of protection of the American dreams, I don't know if he can do it. Maybe he can, maybe he can't. I don't know if he intends to deliver it, but I can tell you what, the simple rhetoric that he's communicating around the mainstream media direct to his audience through his Twitter feeds is reshaping and remaking the body politic.
Bill King brought that up. Bill King said he is a master of finding where the hot buttons are and pushing those buttons, whether they're Democrat or Republican, he doesn't care.
Right. And I think that in November, we could see further deterioration in the economic party base. If Trump is able to frame the issues, continue to frame the issues in a way that working class Americans can agree with.
Isn't it amazing the Democrats keep focusing on, oh, the Russians are the ones who put him in? It's like, really? Really? The Russians put Trump in and because they wanted what we're seeing right now? Is that what they were looking for?
Because they wanted a strong dollar, or because they wanted us to go after Iran, one of their trade partners.
How many people, Dave, are really paying attention to what the Democrats keep trumping up, I guess, pun intended, on this Russia thing? I could care less when I listen to it. How about you?
Gallup did a poll to see how big a deal the Russian thing was, you know, as a threat to Americans and, you know, sort of the, with the midterms coming up, the possibility of greater interference of Russians in the election and things like that. And again, it's mainstream media, it's the Democrats that continue pushing this meme. Honestly, I think they're ruining their shot at capturing voters' attention, because it's, at least according to this Gallup poll, it doesn't even register. You know, it's not even a low single-digit concern. I don't care what you think about Trump. If you're not sensitive to what other people are thinking, if you're not aware of what's in the constituent's mind, then you don't know what game you're playing. You don't know who your audience and how the message needs to be crafted. And that, again, is, I think, where Trump is maintaining an advantage. He's simply picking the right hot button issues. And, you know, while the economy is helping him, I think he'll maintain pretty high approval ratings.
So as we've stated over the last few weeks, Trump's only real concern probably going into the midterms is monetary tightening.
I mean, this has to be the Republicans' greatest risk, whether they recognize it or not. While they have something of the wind at their backs with the economy improving, appreciate the role that monetary policy has played up to this point and the way in which it can batter down the financial markets in particular. So coming into the midterms, if we have further monetary tightening, that is raising rates, it may affect the stock market negatively. And that would throw a lot of relief to the Democrats. And it was very astute for Trump to start connecting the dots here in recent weeks to the economic and financial market impacts, the consequences which result from Fed tightening. Mm. You know, as he's squawking and again, maybe he's crossing a line. Whatever he's doing, he's certainly expressing that he doesn't want rates to go any higher between now and the end of the year. And I think what he's done, again, I suggest that this is very astute on his part, because if the markets do unravel before the election, he's basically created a scapegoat on the Fed. And he can try to shift blame from himself and his own policies and his agenda priorities and say, well, look, everything was fine. I told them not to, and they went ahead with it anyways, and this is what they served up to you.
Do you think he's catching them off guard, to those who still oppose Trump, just because he doesn't speak Ivy League?
Yeah, I mean, as a person, he's unpalatable, but by personality, I don't think he, in terms of decorum, you know, I can think of about 10 categories where on a scale of 1 to 10, he registers somewhere around a 2 or less.
But everyone says, you know, I don't like his personality, but.
But he's not an idiot.
Yeah.
But he's not an idiot. And again, your impression may be that he's an idiot, but I've met a number of sort of New York cosmopolitan types that, yeah, they went to the right schools, they worked for the right bank or the right law firm, and they speak with the right diction, they vacation in the right places, usually the south of France, and Trump doesn't fit their grid as a cosmopolitan leader. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's, and again, I'm kind of speaking from the standpoint of stereotype here, but he's like a Texas hick being elected to the office of president. There's this dismissive attitude that's common among the cosmopolitan elites, and I think it actually factors into Trump being underestimated, right? So they're assuming that he's just an idiot, and at some point the world's going to figure it out. Well, what if he's not an idiot? And what if he's moving a certain number of agenda items and they're assuming that they're speaking to a very broad audience that agrees with them that he's an idiot? And in fact, they lost their audience long ago. I'm very fascinated to see what happens in the midterm elections from a sociological standpoint. I have no dog in the fight. I don't vote Republican and I don't vote Democrat. So truly, I don't have a dog in this fight.
Well, and how many clients have you had through the years and friends that you've had through the years who own ranches in Texas that come across sort of, aw shucks, I don't really know much.
Man,
and you realize, wait a second.
Smart as a whip.
Yeah, yeah, they're dumb like a fox.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's the anger and it's the shock among Democrats, which is acute. I mean, I sat this weekend at the Mount Princeton, just below where we hiked and climbed a mountain. There's a great hot springs there.
Yeah, you sit right in the river, don't you? Right on the side of the river is the hot springs while the cold river runs by.
You know, and above the gurgle of the stream, there's these conversations, and I'm listening to one about the similarities between Hitler's inaugural speech and Trump's inaugural speech, and this historical analogy to Hitler, which was pervasive, I think, in 2016, and it's still lingering. And what was fascinating to me is this, because the accusation which is often leveled is that it's fear which Trump is leveraging for his success. And he's taking advantage of fear of immigration and fear of this and fear of that. But as I was listening to this critique of Trump, and again, this sort of, I don't know that it's a true historical analogy to Hitler, but there's a foundational response which is including fear, right? And it's like, well, we think that he's a fearmonger. But the only critique they have is also based on fear. And it just reminds me that hyperbole is the curse of partisan politics. And it's the one reason why politics, and this might be a stretch, but why politics is a little like eschatology to me. And I'm not really talking about the categories as much as I am the people. Sometimes people speak so emphatically about topics that are far more complex than they represent and are presented in such a way that they assume they have more certainty on a particular topic than is reasonable or really truly representative of the underlying reality.
Well, yeah, both politics and eschatology affect our lives, but it's those people who play fast and loose with the facts. You know, it gives both subjects a black eye. And it's like what you're saying, you know, at this point, people are moving to reactionary, emotional types of responses. The facts really are not being looked at.
I don't think people care to have honest debate. I mean, it's a lot easier to sort of argumentum ad hominem. And I saw it during the Clinton administration. Conservatives do the same thing with the Clintons.
Yeah.
It was attack against the man. There was really no discussion about policies. It was almost depicting the man as the Antichrist. And therefore, I mean, and I just, what I never appreciated about politics is the lack of engagement, true engagement.
And don't you think it can go the other direction as well? Okay, some of the family members I was with this weekend, I know some of you listen, I love you very much, but I heard from some family members who really love Trump, them saying things that I know he can't possibly do. You know, they're happy with the economy, they're happy with a lot of the decisions that he's making. And so at this point, there's just an assumption that he'll solve the debt problem. Where did that assumption come from? And it reminds me often, we have a tendency to have these almost personality cults with our leaders. You see it in churches, you can see it sometimes in companies. You see it with presidents oftentimes. I think we had a little bit of that cult type of personality with Obama. There were a lot of people who loved Obama and thought that he could do almost anything because he was the first black president and because he represented something that had never been seen in America in the minds of the people. That's where we have to be careful and add objectivity to our discussion.
Oh, that's right. I mean, you know, Ray Dalio may write a big, thick book about investing and creating a culture with his investment company. Obama may lead in a certain way. Warren Buffett may, you know, invest in a certain way. None of these guys are perfect. And all of them are subject and to legitimate criticism and discussion about things that they believe and think and whatnot. Just as a thought experiment, what is the market impact? What is the political impact of announcing another tax cut?
You think that might happen?
Well, I think this is why you have to care about politics, even if your primary interest, whether it's in this podcast or any other, is primarily in investing, because there are impacts in the marketplace from things that happen at a policy level. If the markets are in retreat at some point between now and the elections, does Trump dust off a little bit more deficit spending? You know, so does the fiscal policy maneuvers become kind of a primary tool to smooth things over through the midterms? We suggested a few weeks ago that there may be some underlying political bias at the Fed. And as we've seen revealed here in the last few months, there is clear political bias at the Department of Justice and FBI. But even without diving into those murky waters, the Fed now also has the opportunity under Powell to make its case for political independence, because here is a president that, again, as the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times and everyone else is saying, Trump is breaking with precedent. He's speaking to monetary policy directly and he's putting pressure on the Fed. Well, what position does that put Powell in? Mm-hmm. Does he acquiesce and not raise rates? Or does he make his case for political independence, hike rates several more times between now and the end of the year? Powell may not wish to be remembered as a weak Fed chief. I don't think that's likely. So what is he going to do? Powell's going to do his job as he sees fit. I think what I like, Powell, is there is a bit of the Volcker realist in him. Mm-hmm. And I think he has enough backbone to not really care.
Volcker definitely disengaged with politics. And that's why the Reagan administration didn't like him. Going back to my discussions when I was in the Hot Springs in Glenwood, I didn't know you were going to the Hot Springs in Princeton. I was in the Hot Springs with Glenwood.
We needed it. I can tell you, I'm still having a hard time walking. And I'm looking at my little four-year-old going, how did he do it? Because he walked all the way up unassisted. I carried him halfway down, but he made it all the way to the top on his own.
Yeah, that's incredible. He's a McIlvaney. He's a McIlvaney.
I couldn't believe it. And my daughter, age 7, this was her first 14er as well. Yeah. They were troopers. I mean, I'm sitting in the hot springs just going, I think someday I'll recover from this.
Well, you know, as we were talking in the pool, family members and I, one of the things that they pointed out was how strong the economy is. Now, that perception, I could tell, came from the stock market rising. And I really didn't want to go there this weekend. I didn't want to be Kevin the gold broker downer, that guy. But I wanted to just let them know, hey, it really is 4 or 5 stocks that make up the majority of the stock market rise. Otherwise, this would be unimpressive. And as far as the debt, the increase in debt spending under Trump, this is going to be a very dangerous thing to reckon with, because we are now reaching the point of no return. If interest rates do come up, like you said, if Volcker, even a small Volcker card, is played by Powell, the interest expense on this increased debt is unbearable.
Right. Past programs, we've highlighted the fact that you can have an infinite amount of debt as long as you're not paying any interest on it. But the day that the interest rate starts moving up, the bond market holds that reality in check and creates some accountability within the financial markets. Right. It's like checkmate in the game of chess. Game over when you begin to have rates rise, if you're talking about a huge stock of debt or an ever-increasing stock of debt.
So I'm hearing an echo in the background, your dad going, the majority is always wrong. The majority is always wrong.
I think every presentation he ever gave, and still gives, begins with one of his principles, and he's got 5 or 6 or 7 of them, which he introduces his lectures with, and one of them is the majority is always wrong, which is to say, the contrarian view is more often than not a better position to take. That doesn't mean that it's the easiest position to take from a sociological standpoint or a psychological standpoint. It's just that as time and the tide of events roll through, it will have been the better position.
So is a contrarian buying FANG stocks right now? Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, the works?
Yeah, so these guys, the 5 most popular holdings, they are the 5 most popular holdings. If you count who owns them and in what quantities, this is amongst individual investors, this is amongst hedge funds, and this is amongst passively managed ETFs. In 2008, only 5 ETFs held these 5 companies in their top 15 holdings. Mm. Now you've got 605 ETFs, which hold them, that's exchange-traded funds, as a top 15 holding.
Mm. Monkey see, monkey do.
Well, this was a topic that we talked about here last week. These 5 stocks, 4 to 5, account for 75 to 80% of this year's move higher in the S&P. So the appreciation in that index is tied to just a handful of stocks.
What happens when you concentrate that in such a small space?
The concentration of interest is telling, because the concentration of interest in any asset class is the kiss of death. Here's why. You eventually run out of new money to drive prices higher, and what that ends up doing is forcing the old money to convert to liquidating instead of buying. When you run out of buyers, that's the end of a market move. You had negative sentiment for gold, which is the flip side to positive sentiment for stocks. That's today. But there is an interesting mirror here where, you know, on the one hand, you have positive sentiment for stocks, and it really is concentrated in just a few names. Meanwhile, you have wholesale negativity when it comes to the gold market. Doesn't matter what it is, anything related to gold and silver is almost persona non grata within the investment community. I spent some time with an asset manager 2 weeks ago, manages about $1.5 billion in assets, and he said, you know, do you think I should have 50 basis points, 100 basis points allocated to gold? And for him, that would be a first move. He hasn't really considered owning any gold, and that would be a big move for him.
Which is half of a percent or 1%
allocation. Yeah. Yeah. And again, it's that the whole Wall Street world has come to view it as irrelevant. Mm-hmm. And what is relevant, going back to Howard Marks' thought that I mentioned earlier, is that you bet on things that have gone up a lot. And you assume that, it's going to continue that way. And Mark's point was the opposite. No, the big money is not made in the investment world. The dependable money and the safe money is not made following those trends. Kevin, one of the hardest lessons I ever learned as a young investor was using a third-party asset manager in the year 1999 and in the year 2000. This is before I joined Morgan Stanley. Actually, this was one of the catalysts for me joining Morgan Stanley. Insight Capital. Insight Capital was a momentum trader. And they did so well in 99, so well in 98, so well in 97, that as a young investor, I thought to myself, well, why would I use someone who's only made 20% this year when Insight Capital's up 60?
You had those positive chemicals flowing in the blood.
I did not respect the turnaround time, and I got my butt handed to me in late 2000 with that portfolio being down almost 70%. And I thought to myself at that point, there's a lot of things that I don't know, that I want to know, that I need to know, that I'm going to know. And that's when I went to work for Morgan Stanley, because it was my expression of, I will know and I will master this trade.
You tell the story, Dave, about that time you also were reading Barton Biggs, who was a Morgan Stanley broker, but he mistrusted the market because he also understood history. He wrote a wonderful book at the time. What was it? Wealth Wars and Wisdom, or Wealth War and Wisdom. But you were reading his in-house reports, and they didn't represent what the rest of the guys were talking about. I mean, during the tech stock bubble, he's actually writing reports saying, you know what? I think it's about time to buy gold and maybe sell some of these stocks. You took his advice, and sure enough, that paid off.
Well, that was a long time ago, and it was kind of an insider note to the staff at Morgan Stanley. Mm-hmm. And he mentions this crazy derivatives trader, Peter Palmetto, who left the firm in the 80s after shorting the market with everything that he could muster, every dollar he had and every dollar he could collect from friends and family.
Didn't he short just at the right time before the 1987 drop?
He shorted it in 87 and retired to Sun Valley. And the point that Biggs was making was, it's probably time to get in touch with Peter. If you're crazy, if you're stupid. And it was funny how he couched it, because he didn't want to take responsibility for the recommendation, but he was saying he's pedigreed. He's one of us. We thought he was nuts at the time, and he was right. We still think he's nuts, and he may be right. He started Sun Valley Gold, which is sort of a fund of funds for, you know, institutions to invest in mining companies. And Peter Palmetto is an interesting story for me, because he helped bridge the gap from working at Morgan Stanley to coming back and working with our precious metals company here in Colorado.
And probably the only reason Barton Biggs could actually send an in-house memo like that was because he was nearing retirement and he was highly respected. Otherwise, Morgan Stanley probably wouldn't have been talking about gold. But let's go back to the gold market, because you mentioned it a little bit earlier. Let's talk about just the market right now. People are writing in saying, well, when do you think the price is ever going to go up?
Right. And there's a part of me that cares about that and a part of me that doesn't care at all. I'm a long-term holder and investor in gold. The issues which inspired a very significant allocation to metals for me in 2001 and 2002 and 2003, those issues remain. They're the same today. In fact, they've increased in terms of severity and scale.
Well, and you treat it differently. You actually have a goal of how many ounces you want to own in your lifetime and pass on to your family.
Right. So, I mean, long-term, I'm very bullish on gold and silver. And I add routinely to that lifetime ounce objective. Mm-hmm. And so, in part, I'm doing that because I assume that there's a retirement income sort of enhanced by Social Security, which is going to be meaningless to me when that day arrives. Because that system, the social safety net, is broken. And at this point, I think it's beyond repair. But my penchant for saving, for retirement, and frankly, for other future legacy objectives, it gets channeled into what I view as a reliable currency, a currency which is, it's positively impacted, not negatively impacted, by the arbitrary choice of targeting devaluation. I mean, that's the way I see it. When the Fed says we're targeting an inflation of 2%, I say you're devaluing by 2% a year, and we're supposed to be happy about that. That's their inflation target. But, you know, what bothers me is when gold breaks below technical support. It bothers me like it probably bothers a lot of people. Price action, it's gone down. What do you think? It broke below 1240, and I first experienced frustration by a trend that's been down since 2012, and I wonder how low it can go, 1,200, 1,150. These are just meandering thoughts, of course, and emotions, because it's never fun to lose money, but it is fun to make money.
Well, and there's the benefit of having a family and a company that's been in the business for, you know, this is the fifth decade of business. And so when you look at that and say, okay, well, how many times has this happened and where did gold start when the company started? Gold was $35 an ounce when this company started. When I first started here, gold was about $300 an ounce. Okay. Now gold's $1,200 an ounce. Is anything actually really happening here long term?
It's preserving purchasing power through time, which
That's
is
right.
my desire. And at some point, at punctuated points in time, when other assets are cheap, you spend your cash. You spend the currency that you've hoarded on things that represent a compelling value. So, you know, short term, there is that question, how low can it go? But long term, there's the same question, but on the opposite side of the equation. How high can it go? When you have hundreds of trillions of paper promises, which have been made globally with zero intention of payback, when you have tens of trillions or more in money that's been leveraged off the asset base created by that central bank machine, and then you add to that derivative investments and the products related to derivatives, which dwarf the underlying assets which support them. And then you weave in the component of politicians predictably playing for their incumbent position, and they'll do that at any price, and they're playing that through the currency markets and devaluation. And that's just, you know, it's one tool, but it's a predictable tool. You come back to how high can it go?
Right.
How high can it go? And I think it's far higher than market participants can imagine today. I don't know that my dad, when he started our company, had the imagination for seeing gold at $2,000 an ounce off of $35 an
ounce. Or even $1,200. What if we were doing a commentary back in the early 70s when your dad started this and we said, you know, someday gold will be $1,200 an ounce. That didn't even seem realistic
unfathomable.
At that time.
Unfathomable. No. I mean, but what makes a gold market particularly powerful, more powerful than the traditional stock and bond markets as they grow, is that a bull market in precious metals is driven by both greed and fear.
Mm-hmm.
And once you've seen it, once you've seen that dynamic of both coming into play, you'll never forget it. But there is the current price action, which is hardly encouraging if your time frame for selling is today.
Right.
And that's just a reality.
To be fair to the family members I was with, these people also, a lot of them own gold and understand the other side. I think we all have two personalities. In a way, we have, I'll call it healthy schizophrenia. Okay. It's not the kind that's out of control. But there's the part of us that really wonders if we're right every day. And we do go through this, am I right or am I wrong? Am I missing something? And then the other side of us actually looks back at history and says, well, it must be right and we have to do the right thing. So again, I don't want to take a shot. I was listening to the general consensus and there's such a euphoria right now about Trump's success that it's easy for that one personality to start questioning the long term. Now, let's go ahead and look at the gold report though, because it's not just people that are in our sphere that we're talking about. The World Gold Council report said that demand for gold has been falling.
Yeah, and that's, of course, the second quarter of the year. Their report looked at the most recent quarter, and disappointing demand in the second quarter was on the heels of a rather impressive demand dynamic in the first quarter.
Okay.
There's good news with the bad, and the good news is that the consumer, who's sort of the buyer of jewelry, the largest mm-hmm. component of gold consumption, tends to enter the market en masse when the price is low. So the largest consumption demand increases when the price gets cheap, and they like to buy a bargain. And we're now in the consumer sweet spot between now and October, if you're looking at the seasonality of gold. So seasonally speaking, from that standpoint, you've got the Chinese and the Indian buying patterns, which influence the two primary upswings through the year.
That's sort of an annual thing we see.
That's right.
Yeah.
The wedding season in India drives consumer purchases on a predictable seasonal basis, and the Chinese New Year does as well there in the first quarter. So put in terms of quarter, the first and third are typically the strongest for gold, driven not by the investor, but by the consumer demand. The second and fourth quarters are typically the weakest, and we've just finished the second quarter. This is the base, these consumers, they're the base of buyers that drive the price year in and year out. They're the ones that create seasonality. The investor demand component tends to exaggerate whatever trend is in play, negative or positive.
Hmm.
It's what we've always called the swing vote in the markets. They're the ones who are making prices either higher or lower at the margins.
The World Gold Council does believe that consumer purchasing will rise in quarter three, do they not?
Oh, they're very bullish on Q3 for the gold market. And they point out that the futures market is positioning for a significant move higher, where you've got speculators who are more short in the gold market than they have been since, say, the first quarter of 2016, last quarter of 2015, when gold was making its turn at 1050. So what are they looking at? They're looking at the positioning of the commercials and the speculators, suggestive of a shift in price to higher levels. They're looking at global inflation targets being met and surpassed. And their argument is that any number above 3% inflation, and you start to see a migration within the investment community towards gold, doesn't really impact the consumer demand, but it does bring the investor in. And it is worth noting that you've got hedge funds and large speculators which are positioned short gold today.
Aren't they usually on the wrong side of the trade in the long run?
When they aggregate and you can see the numbers at an extreme, yes. So they are as short as they were December of 2015.
Which was the bottom, 1050.
That's right. So trend and momentum, that's what it is. It's trend and momentum following what you see expressed in those large speculators. They're typically concentrated in their bets right as momentum shifts, and that concentration of short bets is on display already. There's another category of demand, which is your central bankers.
Let's look at that, because you've got governments. I mean, I know Russia just sold a bunch of treasury bills and bought a bunch of gold, and I know the central banks are pretty much continuing buying their gold at about the same pace that they have been.
Right. So amongst some of the largest players in the universe, the central bank community, you're seeing an interesting shift from U.S. treasuries and positioning in U.S. treasuries, reducing that and increasing ounces within gold. Russia comes to mind. Turkey comes to mind. Germany comes to mind. These are all countries that are reducing their treasury exposure and increasing their gold exposure. We know that the Chinese have reduced their treasury exposure as well. They don't disclose their gold acquisitions except on a delayed basis, typically 2 to 3 years delayed. So it's sort of the great leap forward when they ultimately do disclose.
So if we were to repeat things that have gone up versus things that have gone down, you know, Howard Marks was saying the real money is made when you buy the things that have gone down, not the things that have gone up.
And assume that they're going to continue going up.
Exactly. So what would you categorize as things that have already gone up?
I put stocks in the category of things that have gone up a lot already. Gold is in the unloved category. As recently as 2012, just roll the clock back a few years and see how this is really all about human psychology and people unable to help themselves do the right things at the right time. You know, Barron's magazine runs an article on gold in 2012 saying everybody should own it. It's the most reliable investment that you can own.
That's when gold was hitting $1,900 an ounce.
That's right. And you've got a 12% per year track record over the last decade. And it's difficult to argue with the track record, except that when you get too many people involved in any one asset class, when you get a clustering of people into that asset class, you ultimately run out of buyers and the price has to go the other direction. So as recently as 2012, you could have said the opposite, that gold was in the category of things that had gone up a lot and stocks were in an unloved category.
Mm.
Are you comfortably contrarian? Well, I'll tell you from personal experience, it's hardly ever the comfortable thing to be.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.